the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Sarita singing Sunny, and a wonderful introduction for me on the Tonight Show from Frank Sinatra. This is John Barber, Monday, October 3rd, 5 p.m. live for an hour, I hope, on John Barber's World from Las Vegas, unless my close friend and the best cohort any talk show could have, unless Joe Satilli cuts me off. In a few moments, Joe and I will be talking to a fabulous writer and meticulous researcher who, next to Jim Garrison, wrote absolutely the best book ever about Mr. Garrison called A Farewell to Justice. And now she has an equally excellent, compelling book about Johnson called Faustian Bargain. And is that a great title? That alone will sell books in America by the thousands. It's not that anyone will understand the word Faustian, but every American knows the word bargain. Anyway, those of you who've downloaded or bought The Last Word on the Assassination from Amazon know that Joan Mellon knows her stuff. When I did this 2 years ago at UNLV, I thought nobody could follow the Garrison tapes. I was wrong. Joan and Jim Mars and Dick Russell expanded on it. They were so good, I told them they could go on the road and take their show off-Broadway. I am truly looking forward to talking to one of my favorite people and favorite writers. But first, I need to answer scores and scores of sweet, curious questions about my being dumped abruptly by George Noory last week after 90 minutes in Coast to Coast. Most of you thought I was dumped for profanity. I was not. First, let me tell you my impressions about conversations in America today, whether on the air or in a coffee shop. There aren't any more conversations. When people aren't on their phones and with someone, listen to them. If they're talking to one another, they are not conversing. They are just exchanging opinions. They wait for the other person to stop whatever he or she is opining about to then get his or her opinion in. George Noory is like that. Unlike Art Bell, who was magnificent, I cannot listen to Noory, let alone have a conversation with him. When I mentioned a famous person about whom I was talking, instead of waiting for a possible story, he'd say, Great guy, I know him, wonderful person. Well, that is very disruptive, especially if I wanted to tell him a story that showed that that person wasn't so wonderful. And when I was talking about a fabulous, unexpected conversation with Nixon's speechwriter on a morning show that I took over in Chicago in the late 70s, over the true reason for the Watergate break-in, which had to do with Kennedy's assassination and nothing to do with George McGovern, and that this terrific 45-minute conversation grew out of just two obscure lines, throwaway lines in this man's book, which I read. Noory interrupts and says, I read all my guest books too. Well, it was as nerve-wracking as watching a woman putting on makeup while driving. I sensed a little unbalanced right at the top of the show when I started to comment about the debates the night before. I mentioned It was the largest audience ever, with the media saying it was the Super Bowl of politics, watched by 80 million people. And I said, they were all TSA agents. And he said, I watched. And then I continued, well, these TSA agents were watching to see if they might have to turn in their uniforms that don't fit. And I was about to continue saying, if it's a Super Bowl of politics, they should conduct the election like a football game with a coin toss. Heads, Hillary or Donald win. Tails, America loses. Then I tried to add, 800 million people around the globe watched to find out who would be bombing them next. And he said, folks, John used to be a comedian. Well, George doesn't know that if people are laughing, they know someone is funny. I was pissed already. I wanted to tell him that Stevie Wonder, at 5:45 before the debate started, called Jose Feliciano. And he said, man, I'm glad I don't have to watch that. And Jose said, man, I don't even want to listen. I don't want to go deaf too. Well, I felt like Moms Mabley, that great black aging female comic who only loved dating young men. She said, dating these old guys is like pushing a Chevy up the hill with a piece of rope. Honestly, I did swear at one point at 2 a.m. Eastern Time, if you consider son of a bitch swearing. But I was quoting our weather girl in Los Angeles in the 70s, with whom I had a constant feud, Kelly Lang, the highest paid weather girl, former Fredericks of Hollywood, bra model. A New York congressman, I believe his name was Lowenthal, and Joan might remember his actual name. I can't quite remember it. But he had a very deep interest in Bobby Kennedy's assassination, and he was in Los Angeles to talk about it.
Howard Lowenstein.
Howard Lowenstein. Thank you so much, Joan. That's exactly right. Anyway, this congressman was, the producer had told Kelly she could do the rest of the show. John was going to do this interview, and she refused to leave the set. Now, we're live on a Sunday. And she sat there. Well, I asked Allard, or Mr. Lowenstein, the first question. He was absolutely stunned that he was talking to someone with whom who had a modicum of knowledge about what happened that day. Kelly never got to ask a question. When the break came and the congressman left, she jumped up in front of the entire crew and maybe 100 people, started swearing at me and calling me a son of a bitch for not letting her ask questions. Now, as I say, son of a bitch, Nori says, no, John, we can't say that on the air. We have to watch that language. Well, at that hour in the morning, it stunned me. So I apologized, and I continued by telling him that I then said to Kelly Lang, all she knew about the assassination of Robert Kennedy was the day it happened, it was 78 degrees, with no response, very similar to Kelly Lang. Now, I mentioned how I was replaced in Chicago by Charlie Rose, and Nuri interrupts and says, he's a giant. And then I said, no, a midget. And then, Ed, he's followed by a black girl from Cincinnati named Oprah Winfrey. And I tried to tell him why ABC, who had her, would not syndicate her. And the King brothers did. And Nuri says, a great lady, or something like that. And I respond by saying, no, George, another useless media billionaire. And Nuri's, I sense, is getting nervous. So he asked me how I got real people on the air. So I said, I wanted Richard Pryor to be my Byron Allen, my co-host. Nuri interrupts immediately and they say, Byron Allen, great guy. I say, well, yes, George, he's worth over $30 million today because he's a triumph of producing mediocrity, okay? $30 million. But when I met him as a 20-year-old kid, he was the dumbest human being I ever met. I know Nuri is upset now and getting irritated. And I continued and I said, when I proposed Richard Pryor as my co-host, Lou Ehrlich, the ABC executive, leaned over the table and said quickly, quote, that nigger's never getting on this network, unquote. And I was never to continue with George Nuri. I was gone. If you listened to his reasons afterwards, you'd have thought I was Lenny Bruce. I was just quoting people. Lisa Lyon, the producer, a lovely, bright lady who should actually be the host of that show, sent me two notes apologizing for not telling me it was a G-rated show even at 2 a.m. in the morning. And I said the G being for god-awful. I informed her factually the next day. Son of a Bitch was heard 5 times in prime time on television in people's living rooms. Now, for those of you who were curious as to why I thought Byron was dumb, if he's a multimillionaire today, let me just modify that or qualify that by saying maybe he was uninformed. Producing Real People, as well as writing and co-hosting, I did a story about a man with his own Madame Tussauds wax museum in his house. Around the table, he had the Beatles seated to keep him company. Byron was 20, going to USC. So I gave the story to him, and he says to me, John, who are the Beatles? A few months later, I did a story about New Orleans street jazz performance and gave that to Byron with an introduction mentioning Satchmo. He rushes to me before the show, and he says, John, who is Satchmo? There are tons and tons of other stories like this, which you will never hear on Coast to Coast unless I'm on Sunday night with George Knapp, who also should be the one that's on 5 nights a week. But I will just leave it at that and tell you you will be able to read those stories. If my book ever comes out next year, it's called Your Mother's Not a Virgin. Now to a fabulous book and one of my very favorite people and one of my favorite writers, Joan Mellon. Joan, thank you so much for being here. I think that's probably the longest introduction you've ever had in your life. But thank you so much, dear, for being here.
Good to hear you, John.
Well, when we talked a couple of years ago, you were talking about doing a book, as I recall, about the Central Intelligence Agency in Texas. How did it morph into Faustian Bargains and Lyndon Johnson and Mack Wallace?
Well, talking about censorship and people not wanting certain ideas out, I wrote that book, Texas and CIA, and the publisher said to me, he saw the last chapter, which had to do with CIA being pleased with Obama. and the head of CIA saying, as long as Obama's president, the CIA has nothing to worry about.
Oh, my.
Well, the publisher read this, and he said, this goes back a few years. He said, I want to vote for Obama in 2012, meaning he didn't want to publish the book. So I decided that this book was, as proposed, a series of chapters about CIA. It had a chapter on Brown and Root. It had a chapter on George de Moorenschild. It had a chapter on King Ranch. And a friend of mine said, named Malcolm Blunt, said, you know, all of these really deserve, each of these deserves a book of its own.
You're absolutely right.
So I had written a contract with this publisher, and we agreed that the book that they would do, more conventional than the others perhaps, was a book about Lyndon Johnson. But it wasn't just Lyndon Johnson, it was the dark side of Lyndon Johnson. It was no longer about CIA, because I think Johnson is even worse than anything we know about CIA. And I focused it on a young man named Mack Wallace, who through whose life and through whose associations with Johnson, we could really see what Johnson was. And so that's how it came to be that this book, Faustian Bargains, which means bargains with the devil, and Johnson certainly was a devil, came to be. I hope that people buy it or read it and see it as things about Johnson that they never knew.
Even if he were not the president, the way you write the book, the fascination with the dark side of a human being, it's really compelling reading.
Well, you know, one of the things I was able to do, you always have to strike it lucky when you do research. I found Life magazine in December of 1963 planned to write an expose of Lyndon Johnson. And they sent their best researcher, whose name was Holland McCombs, into the state of Texas. McCombs was from Texas to get information about Johnson, to talk to the old timers and the old geezers and people, and all those people that Holland McCombs talked to said, please don't use my name. Everybody was afraid of Johnson. So anyway, Holland McCombs left his papers. And of course, Life magazine never ran the story because President Kennedy died and Lyndon Johnson was president. So they're not going to write an expose of the new president. So the Holland McCombs family was from a place called Martin, Tennessee. It's in the middle of nowhere, and I mean nowhere. And Holland McCombs left his papers to this university. And so I went up there. Mainly I went up there to do the research on King Ranch. But I found this huge trove of interviews and essays that Holland McCombs had written preparing for the Life magazine expose. They'd never been published. And I was really lucky. I was able to use that as the basis for how Johnson enriched himself as first a congressman, then a senator, then vice president, and finally president. Well, he came out of there with $25 million.
Back to the reason for the Life magazine article exposing Lyndon Johnson. Don't you think that they might have undertaken that article because they might have heard or learned that John Kennedy was going to dump him, as Nixon predicted?
Well, yes, and the reason for that is they found, they saw his connections, Lord Johnson's connections, with Bobby Baker. And Bobby Baker was going down, and all his scams were exposed, and Johnson was going to go down with him. And that really was the cause. It wasn't Billy Saul Estes. It was Bobby Baker. And Life magazine did run a cover story of Bobby Baker with pictures of Johnson and Baker inside. And Johnson profited enormously from Baker's evil deeds. So now Johnson is president. Bobby Baker goes to jail. And no story appears. So it's a good moment. And then other things happen, such as that a Texas writer told me something. He said, did you ever hear of the USS Liberty? I had never heard of the USS Liberty. The USS Liberty was a spy ship that was attacked in the East Mediterranean in 1967. What I discovered was that the ship was attacked by Israel, who admitted that they did it, by the way, but said it was an accident, which is impossible. And the United States was in on it, too. And Johnson was president. And when the crew of the U.S.
Why would the United States be in on it? I can understand the United States coming to the defense of Israel. You know, that's perfectly understandable. But I cannot see how the United States would be complicit in attacking a spy ship, especially if it's their own spy ship.
Remember that the spy ship is unarmed. And it's in international waters. What the United States was doing with Israel was preparing for a bombing of Cairo and taking down of Nasser. Oh. And what was going to happen was that the ship would sink, everyone would die and drown, and then they would blame Egypt for the attack, and that would be the pretext, just very similar to the Gulf of Tonkin and other such incidents. And then the United States would bomb Cairo. They even had sent planes.
You know what it sounds like, Joan? It sounds like Operation Northwoods. It sounds like 911.
That's right. And I think, don't forget, who was the custodian of Operation Northwoods? It was Robert McNamara. And he continued as Secretary of Defense in Johnson's administration. And so it sounds like Remember the Maine also, which is probably where Lyman Lemnitzer got it and put it in Operation Northwoods, which was designed, of course, to get rid of Castro, not Nasser. But
go ahead.
The sailors on the Liberty managed to get it, even though the attack, the Israelis systematically shot down every antenna that was on deck, all 45, disabling it all. So the idea was the Liberty could not call for help. However, there was one sailor who managed to get one cold antenna and transmitter going. They send out an SOS to the Sixth Fleet. The Sixth Fleet, and the captain is just like a character out of Joseph Conrad out there, the captain of the USS Saratoga. He launches. He doesn't ask anyone. It's an SOS. They're being attacked. He launches. However, shortly thereafter, he has to tell McNamara that he's done it, after he did it. So McNamara says, call back those planes. Now, the captain cannot understand why he wants to call back the planes, that people are being attacked. And then he thinks maybe McNamara assumes that nuclear bombs were attached to those planes. And so he reconfigures the planes so that they cannot hold nuclear weapons and sends them out again. And this time the USS America also launches. Again, a call comes from McNamara. I said, call back those planes. And then the admiral who was speaking to him, whose name was Admiral Geis, he says, I'm not going to, this guy is not even an elected official. He's appointed. So he's not going to listen. At that point, Lyndon Johnson grabs the telephone out of McNamara's hands and says, call back those planes. I don't want to embarrass an ally, which meant, of course, that he knew who was the attacker, because I should have said that the planes that attacked the ship were blacked over. You couldn't see who was attacking.
You know, John, you know, yes. I've read about the USS Liberty for years, as has everyone who is interested in this subject. And I never understood till now why the United States hides the criticism of Israel for attacking it, because I thought that we were just doing that because of AIPAC, because they have so much influence in the United States. But it's not. The United States was defending an ally for an idea that the United States has.
It was an idea that was created by two people. One was the head of the Mossad, which is the Israeli Secret Services, and the other was the head of U.S. counterintelligence at CIA, James Angleton. I said CIA was not involved, I meant Richard Helms was not involved. Richard Helms was the director of Central Intelligence at the time. And so he was opposed to it, but not Angleton. So Angleton and Meir Amit, who was the head of the Mossad, had cooked up this thing, and they hated NASA. NASA was a threat. NASA was not even a threat. As Menachem Begin said years later, there was never any chance that NASA was going to attack Israel. It was all
a pretext. It's like Hussein and Gaddafi, who were never threats, you know? It just reinforces what Martin Luther King said back in 1968 at the Riverside Church in New York. In 68, a year before they blew his head off, he says, I hate to say that, but the largest terrorist organization in the world is my own government. And it just, the stories you tell just reinforce it. Now, in your book, you've made a co-star of this terrific book. You've made it Mack Wallace. You know, you could have made it one of the guys who owned Root, as you called it, or the King Brothers, or you could have made it Bobby Baker, somebody else. You made it Mack Wallace. Why Mack Wallace?
I made it Mack Wallace because in 1984, when he got out of jail, Billy Solestes, with whom Johnson was deeply involved, went before a grand jury in rural Texas and said under oath that Lyndon Johnson had hired Mack Wallace to kill an agriculture official named Henry Marshall, which meant that Johnson was guilty of murder. The first president would be ever to have been accused of murder. And that I thought that was real. And then people later said they became obsessed with this Mack Wallace, whom Billy Solestes had named. And they said that Mack Wallace's fingerprint was in the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository on November 22nd, 1963. So
created a riot when you said that, by the way.
Well, you see, the people that wanted to blame Lyndon Johnson for the Kennedy assassination used that. Here it is, Johnson's acolyte, Johnson's man, up there on the day of the assassination. And therefore, Johnson is guilty of masterminding the assassination, which I don't believe, which Jim Garrison did not believe, which the evidence, the New Orleans evidence, as you know, John, did not say anything about Texans and Texas justice, or any of that. So I hired a fingerprint examiner who was also an officer in the organization that certified latent print examiners. And I gave him there was one print that was in the hands of the Warren Commission that was unidentified. Little finger, one finger. And no one had identified it. It didn't belong to Oswald. It didn't belong to anyone who worked at the depository. It didn't belong to police, nobody. So I hired an examiner, and I took three sets of prints. He didn't lie. One set of prints came from the Austin police because Mac Wallace, our character, had murdered a golf professional who was having an affair with Lyndon Johnson's sister.
Did Johnson hire him to do that? I heard.
Now, look, there's no evidence for that. We can't say that. I have a very strict attitude toward evidence. If you don't claim it, if you can't prove it. But everything that you do claim, be assured you've got the evidence for. That's the way I would do it. So
wasn't Lyndon embarrassed constantly by his sister?
His sister was a pain in the you-know-what, and she was an alcoholic, and she was, yes, an embarrassment. She had a loose tongue, and she talked about him behind his back. Particularly, she had been involved in the 1948 campaign for the Senate, working for Johnson, and so she knew a lot of the dirty linen, and she would talk. She talked. So Johnson hated her as well as his brother. By the way, one of the things I found, this is a slight digression, in the year 1967, when Johnson was getting ready to run again for the presidency in 1968, he had his brother, Sam Houston Johnson, who was an alcoholic, incarcerated at Fort Meade in the hospital, so just to get him out of sight, so he couldn't talk to anyone in the press. So for
unlike years, Jimmy Carter and his brother.
Pardon? Yes, it's a maybe. So, but I don't know if Carter did this. Johnson had his brother in the hospital, and my source was a doctor who was serving his Vietnam time in that hospital, and he observed, here's Sam Houston Johnson coming down from his room to the cafeteria, eating his meals, and going back upstairs, never talking to anyone. And there he was, and it was clear what this was about. Later, I had someone say to me, that witness, he had been sitting next to Sam Houston Johnson on an airplane. He said, my brother is the meanest man I ever met, namely Johnson.
Well, why would Mac Wallace kill the golf pro, the sister?
Quite right. It wasn't because of Joe. Now, I should say one other thing, that is to complicate matters. Johnson showed up in the city of Austin during the time of the trial of Mac Wallace. Now, he was there. What we can say about it, I don't know, but he was there. And my source for that was a fellow named Henry Scarborough, who was a classmate at the University of Texas of Mac Wallace and later became a Trappist monk. So I would say that this was a reliable witness. And he said that he had it secondhand because his friend, his cousin, knew Johnson had shown up and was staying at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin at the time of the trial. Didn't show up at the trial. After the trial, Mac Wallace was convicted of first-degree murder, murder with malice aforethought, and he was given a suspended sentence. Read the book and find out why. It's not Johnson. Anyway, he gets out. He walks out of the jail a free man, even though he'd been convicted of murder, and a year later or so, he gets a job with Temco, which is a big defense contractor owned by D.H. Byrd, who was a great supporter of Lyndon Johnson and not coincidentally owned this book depository at the time of the Kennedy assassination. And here's a convicted murderer getting a job with a defense contractor. And of course, to get that job, you have to have high security clearance. You have to have security clearance at the level of secret. And he got it. I don't have proof that Johnson got it for him, but who else could have possibly done it? And many people speculated about it, but again, we only have the circumstantial evidence for that. But
we're talking to Joan Mellon, who is absolutely a Wikipedia of wisdom about Lyndon Johnson and Jim Garrison. We're going to take a brief break right now, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Joe Satilli, who is really anxious to join in on the conversation. Joan will be right back. Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. Or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you. Welcome back to John Barber's World. We're talking to the irreplaceable Joan Mellon, who's written this fabulous book, as you can hear by what she's been saying, called Faustian Bargains. And we're joined now by the country's very best independent journalist, reporter, and I'm so thankful he's my cohort, has the best news daily newsletter in the country called News Vandal. Joe, it's been a while since we chatted. Thanks so much for filling in with me last time with Ken O'Keefe. I hear you did a wonderful job, and I would have had you interview Joan tonight, but I missed talking to her. So anyway, welcome aboard, and anything you would like to ask Joan, I will ask Joan this first. Joan... In Barr McClellan's book, he said that a grand jury posthumously indicted or named or charged Lyndon Johnson with a few homicides. Is that true?
No. Billy Solestes went before that grand jury in Franklin County, but he only talked about one murder, that agriculture official Henry Marshall, because for that murder, the state of Texas had given him immunity. So he wasn't able to talk about any of the other murders. Now, I personally believe, and we can say this now, because Billy Solestes is no longer with us, that he probably himself had something to do with the murder of Henry Marshall, and that Mack Wallace, in my opinion, had nothing to do with it. Billy Solestes always promised that he had tapes. If you listen to my tapes, then you'll know, because I have Cliff Carter, that was Johnson's right-hand man in Texas, and I have Mack Wallace on this tape, and I begged him until 3 months before he died. I went to see him once, in fact, in Granbury, Texas, but 3 months before he died, I called him again. I said, can I please hear the tapes? No, because this would involve people getting accused of murder, he says, and it would cost $1 million to defend. And, of course, there is no statute of limitations on murder, so maybe he was partially telling the truth. He would be accused of committing murder, and then 3 months later he died. So that was the end of that.
Why did you do the chapter about the naval intelligence?
Because I thought it was very interesting that the Office of Naval Intelligence, starting after the Kinzer trial, when Mack Wallace had been convicted, for 11 years, I think, or 10 years, was trying to take away Mack Wallace's security clearance. Why? I don't know. But maybe they were honest. Maybe they just didn't think that a murderer should be working for a defense contractor. Because after Mack Wallace worked for Temco, he moved to California and worked for Ling Electronics, which had joined up with Temco. So here he is. And so for 11 years, they systematically did investigations. But their problem, they were interested in whether he knew any communists and whether he was a sexual pervert. So none of it was really straightforward or honest. And eventually, the intermediary that was sent by the military to deal with this figured they just couldn't ignore the Navy totally. So they lowered Mack Wallace's security clearance to confidential. But that was one of the reasons I decided to do this book about Mack Wallace, was because a friend of mine, Malcolm Blunt, the same one I mentioned, told me that the Office of Naval Intelligence files were available.
Wow.
Neither classified nor declassified, but they were available, and they had come from the Dallas police, and there they were. So I through the various circuitous methods, include the fact that a police officer from the Dallas police named Jay Harrison, who was very interested in the Kennedy assassination, got the Office of Naval Intelligence files, and he died, and he left it to a writer named Walt Brown, and brought Walt, being kind, you know, liking Malcolm Blunt, gave me the files.
Oh, my goodness gracious. In your research into Lyndon Johnson and into Mack Wallace, was there something that really surprised you, either in a positive way or a negative way?
Great question, John Barber. The thing that surprised me and made me happy was to see Mack Wallace leading demonstrations at the University of Texas supporting the president who had been fired by the Board of Regents. His name was Homer P. Rainey. And the governor of Texas, that's Coke Stevenson, who later ran against Johnson in 1948, and the regents conspired to fire Rainey, and Mack Wallace led the entire student body, 7,000 people, in protest demonstrations that reminded me so much of the demonstrations against the Vietnam War. They were peaceful, they were intelligent, and I put as many photographs of those demonstrations as I could in Faustian Bargains because I wanted people to see, there's Mack Wallace marching down Congress Street with all the students behind him and a coffin, and the coffin represented the death of academic freedom. And we see all the signs, and the music is very funereal. It's still the Eyes of Texas, but it's very funereal and sad. And then Mack Wallace addresses all the students. And the other thing that part of that movement was a football game. I love to write about sports. That's another thing. And there was a football game on that Saturday in which Southern Methodist University played the University of Texas. And they're all there. And Mack Wallace takes his coat off at halftime and makes a speech in favor of Homer Rainey. The whole crowd stands up, and Homer Rainey is crying, and Mack Wallace's girlfriend is so proud of him. She was the love of his life, Nora Ann Carroll. And one of the things that made this book, I think, good for me was meeting her. And she still loved Mack Wallace, even at the age she was close to 90 when I interviewed her in Maine. And she remembered everything. He handed her his coat, and she was so proud of him. And I think it was his finest hour. He was the president of the student body at the University of Texas.
Did the protests do any good? And Joe,
no,
join in.
They did not restore Homer P. Rainey. The University of Texas was censored by the Association of University Professors. Mack Wallace quit school and went to New York. Laura Ann Carroll went home, and she married her childhood sweetheart, and that was the end. So almost the end of that.
Oh, my goodness. Joe.
Yeah, Ms. Mellon, there are so many things that are unsavory about LBJ, about him personally and about him politically and his arm twisting and many of the things that you've uncovered. Putting aside Roger Stone, who anything that kind of comes out of Roger Stone seems to me like it's a psyop or disinformation process that's being unfurled on us because Roger Stone, you just look at Roger Stone and it's kind of hard to, you know, it's kind of hard to believe anything that's coming out of his mouth.
He threatened me with physical harm.
No, it doesn't surprise me.
And what I did was I called my lawyer and he said, never mention his name again. But then that wasn't enough because I was going to a conference in New Orleans about, I was speaking about Jim Garrison. And the threat was, if you come to New Orleans, you will meet physical harm. And of course, I didn't know this, but it's a felony to threaten someone over the internet. It was an email.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I should do one thing. Very surprising for me, but I called the Bureau. We all talking to FBI and Hoover and everything else. That was when you need protection. I called a resident agent in Trenton, New Jersey, and she was very nice to me, actually, and she said, I'll call you back. Now, you may think she didn't call me back, but you'd be wrong. She did call me back, and she said to me one thing. He works for Trump.
Well, there you go. The question that I had, though, and you were talking about what was surprising and not surprising, you know, the thing that's interesting about LBJ, and I think one of the reasons why Roger Stone or there'd be an idea to have a disinformation campaign just to place it on LBJ's doorstep, one, because it's a misdirection and one of hundreds of misdirections since the president was summarily executed in broad daylight, but two, because LBJ's legacy is actually a slightly mixed legacy. And do you ever look at LBJ's legacy and consider what he did on civil rights and see him in any way, shape, or form as a tragic figure?
Well, I don't believe that he cared about civil rights. See, I take the position, yes, he embraced civil rights, it seems. And what he said was he was following President Kennedy's policies. And so he was, and you know, you see him in my book, you have him at 4 a.m. on the night of the next day after the Kennedy assassination. He's unfurling all these, he has already with the Great Society, just as if nothing had happened, and he was all set. Like, how did he know? How did he get to be so all set? And I don't trust his civil rights. I don't think Dr. King did either. And we see how he really acted toward Black people. He said the word that my students don't allow me to say. These days you can't say it. But,
well,
you know, that's the word
that won't let you say it.
That's the word that he said all the time. And he also harassed Black people from the time he was a boy and until the time he was, you know, when he was a grown man. And some of the stories are in Robert Caro's biography, and yes, some of them are in other books. And his attitude toward Black people was shameful. So what is the civil rights? He was trying to create a legacy. He's the same as Barack Obama. They don't have a legacy, but they're trying to get one. And when Johnson had to put all his resources into Vietnam, he was perfectly happy to take the funding away from the Great Society, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and all the rest of it. Now, Robert Caro writes that he was sincere. Oh, no, you're giving cover to Johnson by saying that. I just don't give him any credit for the civil rights. So I have no problem with him as a tragic figure. I think he's truly evil. And very rarely do you find somebody that's so overwhelmingly one side. He is evil. And the calling back of those planes, these boys didn't do anything. Half of them are 17, 18 years old on the USS Liberty. He doesn't give a damn. He said, I don't care if the ship sinks. He actually said that to the admiral. The admiral repeated it. Couldn't believe he was hearing it. So this man, you could say anybody who is true evil is tragic, because they're a corrupted human being. That, and you don't have to be that.
Well, then let's,
but if ever there
next,
was one, it's him.
Let's
sorry,
take
Joe.
The next, no. Let's take it the next step, because I was also interested that you said a word earlier in a conversation with John. It's a word that means something to me, a trained historian and a journalist. You used the word evidence. And it's a rare word today, and I think it's actually a rare word in the world of the Kennedy assassination industry, because there is a Kennedy assassination industry, and if you run afoul of certain people inside the industry, which you seem to have done with a certain segment, there is blowback. And often people get attached to ideas and inferences without evidence. How hard is it to push for evidence when you are
trying? Impossible, Joe. It's impossible. No matter how much evidence you give, documents, interviews, whatever, they won't change their minds. They won't open the book. So I gave a lecture once at one of these Kennedy assassination conferences called On Evidence. And I put it on my website. That's called joanmellon.com. But I put it up there because they don't like me. They say I'm holding to too high standards of evidence. I'm holding to the standards of evidence of the law courts. Yes, I am. And also for history. We cannot, circumstantial evidence is evidence, but it's not the same as direct evidence. We have to which kind of evidence you're using. We cannot use evidence, quote unquote, from other people's books and say the fingerprint is the fingerprint of Mac Wallace because another book said it, namely Barr McClellan, and therefore one book after another repeats the same falsehoods. And Mac, by the way, you know, John, Barr McClellan writes that Mac Wallace recruited Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, I remember. About a week ago, I saw this video from a fellow who does nice YouTubes, James Corbett, I believe his name, and he lives in Japan, and he did an hour on 9-1-1, and all the evidence, and I say evidence that he introduced, and then he said the only thing that prevents this from moving forward is that the 9-1-1 truth movement does not have a Jim Garrison in a position to make a prosecution and bring somebody to trial. But Joan, you saw what happened to Jim. He solved the case in 1967, for crying out loud. And you have all these people in the assassination community preoccupied with trivia about who was on the first floor. What about the fingerprint?
Joe is right. They make life easy for themselves, these assassination researchers, by not adhering to any standards at all. They make up
anything. Well, the other question I have is, do they become, and I'm going to mix a metaphor here, do they become a fertile field to plant red herrings into?
Well, yes, they, whether wittingly or unwittingly.
Right.
That's right. And the idea that the mafia did it sort of wore out. That was served its time. Now they needed an alternate sponsor. And the alternate sponsor after the year 2000 was going to be Lyndon Johnson. And they've pursued it in book after book, TV shows. What do you call that thing? The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and
that's whatnot. That's why it got press, because as you said, the mob had worn its welcome out. Now they got Lyndon Johnson. But if you try to tell Jim Garrison's story, you will not get any press.
But I had more press there. I have to tell you, I had more radio programs on A Farewell to Justice. I can't understand it than on Faustian Bargains. There are people out there protecting Johnson. But one of the things they're also protecting, and John made this point about AIPAC, I don't know, they somehow, because Israel, you see, one of the things about the Liberty, I'm writing a book about the Liberty now, so I'm really into it. But one of the things I am discovering is that Israel has taken the blame for this incident for the United States. They bite their lips because they say, well, we did it, but it's an accident, it's a mistake. But they never say, ever, that it was a collaboration. And that's why that you can never talk about it, because they've done their part. And the United States is now doing its part, which is to suppress anything that's written that even comes close to what actually happened.
Well, because if Israel said that this was the United States' idea, an outgrowth of Operation Northwoods, then the American people would realize that the government kills its own people, as Jim Garrison said back in 1967.
Well, it's a tough road. You're doing God's work, John, by having your program and having people on who express alternate views. Very few, I mean, Leno Sanek does too, but very few people do. And I'll throw up my hands. If word of mouth doesn't do it, then that's going to be it. But at least I put it between covers with the footnotes, with an appendix, by the way, from the Certified Print Examiner on his methodology.
I see it. And the thing is, you said that you called Lyndon Johnson a tragic figure. Even
that's Joe that called him a tragic figure.
No, it was a question I had if she thought he was a tragic figure.
Okay, but the point is, you can't say he's tragic if he suffered a horrible end. It was a suffering that was earned and deserved. So how could you say, I mean, at first.
That was the horrible end. The horrible end is that he didn't get reelected, that he couldn't run again because he didn't want to be humiliated. Because I can tell you, people would have gone out against him in that election in 1968 and protested. He couldn't get elected. So he crawled back to his ranch. And that's not the end of the world.
No, but at the end of the book, you have this really fascinating chapter called Downward Spirals. And I thought, well, gee, maybe this is going to be a little bit like Shakespeare's Macbeth, you know, which I thought was really tragic. But it's not. Now, in McClellan's book, he talks about Lyndon Johnson having psychiatric disorders and had to have a psychiatrist make house calls. How true is that?
I don't have it. I don't know it. I don't have it. I wouldn't believe a word Barr McClellan said. So Barr McClellan had all kinds of fantasies about Mack Wallace also.
Yes,
how he died and all this. And I'm just, it may be that Johnson saw a psychiatrist, although he wasn't an introspective man. So I don't know what to say about it. I don't have it. I don't have Billy Solesi's tapes, and I don't have, anyway, you know, psychiatrists would never give authors the records of, that's medical records of.
Now, this nice lady says to you of Stone that he's a Trump person.
The FBI, that was the resident agent in Churton.
Yeah,
she said he works for Trump. We already knew that, of course.
Okay, now you look at what's happening in America today. You see Hillary Clinton and you see Donald Trump, two people in the 60s or 70s who couldn't even run for mayor of a city, let alone president of the United States. Has America degenerated so far down that we finally
people are so miserable that they'll do anything to vote for anyone who, like in the case of Trump, anything is better than what they've got now. They don't want it. So then Hillary is the alternative to that. Some people,
the picture you paint of LBJ.
Yeah.
Kind of makes, you know, Trump look like an amateur version of sort of sociopath that LBJ was. I mean, you know, I sometimes do get a little bit maudlin when I hear people talking about how there were these good old days and there were these good old days. I mean, the good old days of Andrew Jackson, of Jefferson, who used to write about the little black boys in the nailery who weren't producing enough nails and needed to be whipped. I mean, you know, American history is not there's not this sort of aren't these halcyon salad days, which is actually one of the reasons why I think the assassination of Kennedy has such a hold over so many people, because it does seem, and I'm a big fan of the Douglas book, that he had an epiphany or an evolution, particularly in light of the missile crisis, as a potential peacemaker among peacemakers in terms of American presidents and the American political process. And he was a unique figure in many ways when you look at many of the people who have become presidents. I mean, Ronald Reagan, COINTELPRO, George Herbert Walker Bush, maybe the most successful CIA agent in the history of the CIA. I mean, the kind of list goes on and on.
You know, I found out something very interesting about President Kennedy doing this research, and that was how strongly he tried to prevent Israel from getting the atom bomb. And Shimon Peres, who died a day ago, said to Kennedy, "You can be sure Israel will not be the first country in the Middle East to have the atom bomb." And of course, he was lying, and he did just that. But President Kennedy didn't believe anybody. He wanted international inspections of Dimona, the Israeli nuclear reactor. And they were building, they were making on atom bombs there, right and left. And somehow Israel always avoided those inspections. And it was a Sabbath. It was this. It was that. And then, of course, President Kennedy dies. We get Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson wouldn't have dreamed of asking for inspections of Dimona. And even now, it's psychotic. You hear about this deal with Iran, about the atom bomb. But what about Israel has a big stockpile of nuclear weapons?
Well, not only that, Joan, they imprisoned one of their own scientists for 10 years for saying that we have atom bombs. And then before Kennedy died, aside from wanting inspections at Dimona, he was bringing a lawsuit against AIPAC and wanted them registered as a foreign lobby. That pursuit was dropped when Lyndon Johnson became president. And getting back to Johnson, you mentioned the fact that within hours, 4 a.m. in the morning, he is unfurling these papers about the new society or whatever you wanted to call it.
The Great Society,
okay.
Right.
And Jim Garrison said when I interviewed him on September 5th, 1981, he said, "John, if you know the government and the military, this is something that takes years of position papers. And one of the position papers was a memorandum 273 signed by McGeorge Bundy the day before Kennedy died, dated November 21st, reversing John Kennedy's withdrawal policy in Vietnam. And that is never mentioned by anyone." And now George Bundy becomes the military advisor to Lyndon Johnson and became what is called, along with McNamara, the major architect of the Vietnam War.
It's ironic because when McGeorge Bundy was writing his autobiography, and it was called Lessons in Disaster, and he died before it was completed, he depicts how every day the cabinet, McGeorge Bundy, Dean Rusk, the whole McNamara, they were begging him to send ground troops, send just one, send two, send 200, whatever, to Vietnam, and Kennedy resisted. So it's interesting, he sort of admitted that in that book. It's a very good book to have on your shelf, Lessons in Disaster.
Well, so I must
it's more evidence for us about President Kennedy.
Oh, evidence! I love that word.
I didn't do that self-consciously.
What was that you just said, Joe? I missed that.
I said evidence. I love that word. She's talking dirty to me.
Okay. Joan, I want to thank you so very, very, very much for being here. I miss talking to you. I'm about halfway through editing this monumental documentary that Joe is making a major contribution to. It's called the Part 2 of the Garrison Tapes, in which Jim tells stuff that nobody has ever seen or heard, which is monumentally informative and brilliant. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And I assure you, as knowledgeable as you are about this, and you're as knowledgeable as anyone I know, you are going to find new revealing information in this documentary. Anyway, where can folks get Faustian Bargains? Where can folks get your Jim Garrison book? Where can folks go?
These days, the only place you can get books is Amazon.com. So you can get Faustian Bargains at Amazon.com, and also A Farewell to Justice, the updated 2013 version.
Well, it is wonderful. I have two of them. I have two of the Faustian Bargains. And Joe, your News Vandal, where can folks get that, and where can they hear you again?
Well, just go to newsvandal.com, and there'll be a little screen pop up. You can sign up, and then tomorrow night I'll be on the Ocelli Effect on American Freedom Radio, and then again back here next weekend. I know, and every Friday on Crew FM, KRUU-FM, I do the week that was, a wrap-up of the week at 2:30 Pacific.
The fellow that you work with is wonderful, by the way. The two of you do a terrific, terrific...
Great James Moore. I've been doing that show for 5 years.
Wow. You both deserve much larger platforms than John Barber's world, but you make my world a lot happier and a lot more hopeful having you to talk to. You have
well,
both.
It was fun, John. I appreciate your calling me. I really do.
Well, I adore you, Joan. I adore your work, and you will be back before the end of the year. Okay, dear?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you, Joe.
And
both
you too,
again.
Joe. Thanks to
take care.
Nice meeting you.
Okay. As Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.